This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. For decades, international trade has been the lifeblood of the global economy. But a global pandemic has forced many countries to look inwards to control the spread of the virus. The question is, how will that affect existing patterns of international trade? And I'll be tackling this subject together with Simon Evnett, Professor of International Trade at the University of St. Gallen. He's also founder of the Global Trade Alert, an independent monitoring body which looks at policies affecting world trade. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to join you.
Take us through, perhaps, first of all, what are some of the biggest threats that you would see to international trade today?
I think we have to differentiate between trade in goods and trade in services and digital trade. The latter two are doing really well at the moment, and cross-border delivery of services, as you can imagine, has boosted as a result of COVID-19. If you think of everyone subscribing to Netflix, using Zoom and things like this, that side of the world trading system is doing quite well. The trading goods, on the other hand, is being crimped quite seriously by, of course, restrictions on the movement of ships, more importantly, shipping crews. You've got air travel restrictions and the like, which are holding things back. But of course, on top of that, we have other more direct government policies restricting the exports of medicines and medical equipment. Some of that has been unwound, but they are still there. And I think generally the biggest problem has been that the pandemic response by many governments has not been particularly well thought through. And we have a wave of subsidies which have been offered to specific firms, and this will distort international trade. So I expect that trade in goods will continue to be pretty sluggish. It will rebound somewhat this year and next year, but I think the growth path of it will remain sluggish, and it will become more and more distorted by governments who are offering large amounts of subsidies to domestic firms and to exporters.
Now, it's tempting to think that the pandemic might be the biggest, perhaps, impact to globalized trade in recent years. But wasn't it also true that globalized trade was also under attack even before the pandemic? You know, will this just accelerate a shift that was perhaps already in place?
I broadly agree with that. In fact, international trade in goods has been slowing down since the global financial crisis. Before the global financial crisis, we used to reckon that for every 1% increase in national income or world income, we would see a 2% increase in world trade. After the financial crisis, that ratio went down to 1-for-1. And in fact, there were periods in the middle of the last decade where world trade volumes were stagnant. And I think the COVID pandemic will reinforce that trend. So we'll see probably anemic trend growth in world trade and goods once the rebound has happened and we get back up towards the levels that we saw before the pandemic hit. After that, I expect we'll see much more slower trade growth and possibly even a plateauing of world trade, depending on how much production is repatriated home or the degree to which 3D printing also reduces the need for long supply chains. So especially there are technological developments which are also undermining the prospects for international trade in goods, not just policy developments.
So, a common pattern of behavior during any time of crisis is this desire to turn inwards and focus on oneself, perhaps to the exclusion of others. I mean, this applies at the individual level as well as at the national level. But in some of your works, you discuss the fact that of how important it is to keep goods and services flowing during a time of crisis like this pandemic. Perhaps you could talk to us a little bit more about that.
Let me begin by agreeing that there is this apparent instinct of many policymakers to turn inward whenever there is a crisis and to start seeing international trade relations as them versus us. This is not really a viable policy option in the 21st century, especially since we've had decades of cross-border investment and the development of a thick web of cross-border supply chains. And essentially, we've got to the stage now where many countries are often implicated in the production of essential goods like medical equipment. If you take a medical ventilator, which was, of course, at a premium in the early part of the pandemic. This is often made of dozens of parts from lots of different countries. And so if a country tries to exert power over its part in the supply chain, they will disrupt production in many other countries. And it's not really conceivable to, in very short order, reconstruct such a supply chain domestically. So there's a potential there then for the instinct, the reflective instinct to turn inward, to result in some very damaging disruption to cross-border supply chains and to the supply of essential goods. And that's essentially what we saw. Now, on top of this has been another instinct, which is that we should diversify our sourcing patterns because we're too dependent on any one country. And of course, people have in mind here, typically China. It's the most detailed studies of sourcing behavior of firms show that when firms do face disruptions to their supply chains, actually having a diversified supply chain, diversified set of suppliers slows down the rate at which a supply chain can recover its previous output level. And so these types of practical findings fly in the face of these reflexive instincts that many policymakers, and I suspect many members of the public, have as well. And so I think the realities of 21st century business really call into question some of the more instinctive responses of policymakers when there's trouble. And I think these points cannot be explained often enough to senior decision makers. And this is not a matter of opinion or sort of normative perspective. This is really about the serious practical issue of how do we ramp up production in essential goods and distribute them across the world. This very practical problem is best served by the current set of supply chains that we have, and governments shouldn't be going around trying to disrupt them.
You've also talked about the fact that there's no single crisis playbook, really, that all countries in the world are able to implement. So give us an overview, perhaps, of the spectrum of decision-making that we saw over the first months of this year as the pandemic ramped up, and perhaps some of the resulting fallout that you saw.
We do see a big variation in the behavior across governments. There are countries such as those within Western Europe who initially reflexively started to try and hoard or prevent exports of these items. And then there are other countries such as Japan, Canada, and to some degree Australia, which decided that they were not going to disrupt the supply chains for the delivery of these particular goods. And it's interesting that, Japan, Canada, and Australia, these are big trading nations. They're members of the G20, and they didn't feel the need to succumb to the type of beggar thy neighbor policies. And you can hardly argue, and I don't think anyone argues, that their pandemic response was worse on account of failing to disrupt the supply chains and prevent exports. So I think that's one important decision point, was whether or not countries were going to try and grab as much of the medical supplies produced in their country and keep it there on the grounds that we need it. It turns out that was neither necessary nor sufficient for a effective corona response. A second type of intervention that we saw earlier this year was a big bidding war in overseas markets for whatever medical kit was available. And we also saw governments redirecting planes worth of kit to their country from other countries. This was called by one German minister modern piracy, and it's a pretty accurate account. So we had essentially bidding wars there, which were another very important feature of the early part of this crisis. A third feature, which goes in the opposite direction, positive news, was that many governments looked at their import regimes and saw that they were taxing the importation of items which help fight corona. So let's just take, humble bars of soap. Before the coronavirus hit, there were about 150 countries which taxed importation of soap. To the credit of many governments, and I think around 90 of them did this, they actually liberalized their import regimes to make it easier to source soap, PPE, and other medical equipment from abroad. And those import reforms then, I think, have really helped ease the flow of needed medical goods. The other aspect I should put on top is that, and this is outside of the medical sector, is that, of course, governments responded to the falling national incomes and sharp falls in national incomes in different ways. The problem occurs when governments decide to use crises like this for industrial policy purposes to try and build up one or two firms or to favor a certain industry. And there's no better example of this than the bailout of Lufthansa by the German government. And the bailout was valued at around 9 billion euros, three times the stock market valuation of that company at the time of the bailout. And the CEO of Lufthansa told the Financial Times the German government was far more generous than it needed to be, and that the German government's motivation was to position Lufthansa well in amongst global airlines after the pandemic. And so you can see here that, that this particular bailout was not driven by the necessities of crisis response, but by strategic positioning. And that's the type of bad policy we want to avoid.
So outside of the immediate concerns of the global pandemic, over the past couple of years, it does seem as if there has been little appetite for countries to liberalize their trade practices. In fact, we have seen the rise in protectionist policies, very nationalist sentiment. And, you know, if that's the case, you know, coming out of this global pandemic, is there going to be a way to reverse any of the trade distortions that you've seen? Or is a slow death of free trade really all that we can hope for?
I think here a little bit of perspective will add value. The global financial crisis, when it hit in 2008 and 9, led to a big wave of subsidies as well. And at most, half of them were reversed, at least the subsidies to import competing firms. The subsidies to exporters were never reversed. So those trade distortions are largely still in place today. And as you noted, over time, we've had more and more trade distortions compounding on top of each other. And we have no sort of mechanism at the global level to encourage the unwinding of these particular trade distortions. So there are, you know, if the recent history as well as history going back 10 years does provide grounds for some pessimism. But I do want to emphasize that we do see governments liberalizing from time to time, and governments are not all the same. You have countries in your region who are very committed to open trade. And I have in mind here countries like New Zealand and Singapore, who have made, I think, a brave stand trying to say that openness is what they stand for. And so we will see countries, I think, start signing free trade agreements, unilaterally liberalizing their policies. But it will be hard to see developments at the global level, given that there are also plenty of other governments who've lost the appetite to cooperate on trade policy matters and to reform their economies using trade policy.
I'm speaking with Simon Evenett, Professor of International Trade at the University of St. Gallen. Up next, tackling the subject of the WTO and whether or not it's still relevant in this day and age. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Simon Evenett, Professor of International Trade at the University of St. Gallen and founder of the Global Trade Alert, an independent monitoring body looking at policies affecting world trade. So, Professor, you talked about the fact that there is no wider global encouragement for countries to unwind some of the distortionate policies that they have put in place over the past couple of years. What role does the WTO play then, seeing as it is charged with protecting rules-based trade? There has been some cynicism thrown at the WTO's door, saying that it doesn't seem as if it has been particularly effective. Will this pandemic just accelerate its slide into redundancy?
I think that if you look at the track record of the WTO since it was created, I mean, there are grounds for some degree of pessimism. But I also sense that in the last few years, there's a realization among more and more governments that the status quo is probably untenable and that we do need to find ways to get this organization back on track. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to go back to doing what it was always doing. The formula or the recipe for success for tomorrow doesn't have to be the recipe of success from yesterday. And so you do get the sense that there are a number of medium and smaller sized economies who get it. There are some bigger economies which are also very keen on seeing the WTO revived. And you can think, if you think of the European Union as one big such economy, they are supportive. I also think China would like to see a relatively effective WTO as well. Now, of course, the all eyes at the moment will be on the new Biden administration to see how far they're prepared to go. But what we have to do in the short run with the WTO is a series of confidence building steps, which will help policymakers see that Geneva is the place where you can still do business on trade policy. Then we have to have a much more profound conversation about where do we want this organization to be in 10 or 15 years from now. At the moment, various camps at the WTO are talking past each other. And that, I think, is regrettable, but it's a consequence of the stalemate that we've seen over the past 15 years. But I do see, as I said, I do see some signs of more governments wanting to turn this organization around. And as the old saying goes, the night is darkest just before dawn.
Indeed. I am curious, though, about what you've said about China, because China isn't necessarily the country that you would typically associate with any kind of protector of free trade. In fact, China, I think, has fielded a number of complaints against them at the WTO since it became a member in the early 2000s. So what makes you say that China would want to see a more efficient WTO in the long run?
Well, I think China has very strong stakes in the multilateral order, especially as it relates to commercial relations. After all, they are a major exporter in the world economy. They need open markets, or rather, they need markets to be open for their products abroad. The other thing is the Chinese, at least from what I have seen of their government officials, they do not act like a bull in a china shop. Sorry to use that. That wasn't an intended pun, but it sort of came out. They don't act in a reckless manner. And if a system is in place, which they have signed up to, I think they will be the last ones to want to tear it down. So that's not to say, by the way, that like every other country, they'll have internal debates about just how open they want to be. So I don't see the Chinese as a wrecking ball in the world trading system. There are others who argue that China's domestic policy mix is hard to reconcile with WTO obligations. Mm-hmm. And you can have a very good discussion about whether that's true and whether China is exceptional. But I think that's the type of technocratic discussion which needs to happen. And I suspect that as you unpack that particular issue, you'll find that any set of rules one tries to put in place to improve Chinese economic policy is going to implicate many other countries' policies as well, especially countries with aggressive industrial policies.
With trade blocs like the recently signed RCEP, or the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, popping up, will the WTO at the end still be relevant? What kind of a role will they play if the global trade landscape starts to turn towards more of these sort of regional multilateral trading partnerships?
I would argue that the spread of those big deals has not been as wide or as profound as many people thought would happen. And still, all of the members of RCEP are also members of the WTO. So I think these tensions will get managed. And I'm not one of these people who tends to think that regional integration comes at too much at the expense of global integration. I do understand that policymakers have a certain amount of focus and they could probably only focus on one major initiative at a time, but that doesn't mean that the WTO is always going to be sidelined. But I do think it's an absolutely fair point to be skeptical about the WTO given the track record of the last 15 years. So sometimes I think of the WTO as a bit like one of those fading Italian palazzos, which you could look at from the outside and see its former glory. You can see that the palazzo is still standing, desperately needs renovation, and that it could have a great future. But that doesn't mean that someone's going to pick up the paintbrush and get in there and start cleaning this architecture up. So I think that's the right way to think about the WTO as an organization which had a great launch, a great start, and which has lost its way. But that doesn't mean that we can't take control of this organization collectively and drive the world trading system in a direction which is much more constructive.
So if you were to take up that paintbrush, so to speak, what would be some of the ways in which you would try and rebuild the World Trade Organization? Because, there are concerns over a multitude of areas in the WTO, one of them being as well the dispute settlement system, which doesn't appear to be utilized as much as it once was. It could well be that we may see larger disputes as well on the between countries. So the Airbus and Boeing dispute is a long-running one, but it's also things like, you know, the EU versus US tech companies. Sort of those kinds of questions are still hanging in the balance. What will the WTO need in order to step up to deal with them in an effective manner?
Right. So you're quite right. There's a big menu of things to tuck into here. But we need to start with a small amuse-bouche, to continue the metaphor. Specifically, one of the things I have in mind is a sort of memorandum of understanding amongst countries to keep their imports free for medical goods and for other essential items, including the vaccines when they come, and also for governments to refrain from using export controls. So that would be one area where you could boost confidence amongst WTO members. Another area that WTO members have got to get their act together in is in talking openly and reporting openly on what their governments are doing. A third area, as you rightly say, is we have to figure out how on earth trade disputes are going to be resolved in the future. It seems that the current arrangements have lost the support of some key players, and they haven't lost the support of everyone, but they have lost the support of the United States for sure. And so some new system has to be constructed. And another very profound conversation is how do we take the WTO rulebook and expand it for the digital economy, which the rulebook in that area is in its infancy. But I think we have to start with the baby steps before we get onto the really big ticket items. But this is a process which could unfold over a 3 to 5 year period quite effectively.
And Professor, for a last question, you mentioned the US. So, and of course, talked about the fact that everyone is looking ahead towards a Biden administration. What are your expectations out of a potential Biden administration come January? Do you think that we will see the US reposition itself, perhaps moving away from the more protectionist policies introduced under Donald Trump?
So the answer to that question is yes and no. So the good part is that I think both the attitude, the rhetoric will change markedly. There will not be more bombastic attacks on trading partners, including China. There will be warm words for multilateralism. Grounds for skepticism, however, are that it will be very hard politically for President Biden to unwind the tariffs on Chinese imports. That, I think, will be very difficult for him to do. It'll be very difficult for him to put a far-reaching trade agreement before the US Congress. And I think it will be very hard generally to muster support among the American population for further trade reform. So I'm fully expecting essentially a calming in the geopolitical or trade-related geopolitical tensions with China. Certainly not the cessation of them. I'm not expecting any big multilateral initiatives to come out of Washington, but I think other countries may be willing to propose them and Washington won't get in the way. And I certainly don't think we'll see an aggressive free trade agreement policy, not during the first term of any Biden administration. So the rot will stop, the words will get better, but deeds will fall short, I think, of what many multilateralists are hoping for.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us this morning, Professor. It's been a very interesting conversation. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much as well.
I've been speaking with Simon Evanett, Professor of International Trade at the University of St. Gallen. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.